a primary election recap. The big night for incumbent Republicans in Hamilton County, the matchup for mayor in Indianapolis, disappointing voter turnout, and mixed results in school referendums. That plus bills signed by the governor, Deflategate, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 8, 2015.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, Jim Brainerd won a sixth term as mayor of Carmel. It was a resounding win. Brainerd won 63% of the vote in the GOP primary against City Council President Rick Sharp.
It means that the people in Carmel want us to be something more than a bedroom suburb. They want to see revitalized downtown. They want to see a great park and trail system. And they want to see us compete against the best places in the country as a great place to live, work, and raise a family.
Was it foolish for critics to challenge Brainerd? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Mike McDaniel, does this mean that voters are not concerned about the amount of debt Carmel has?
Voters clearly in Carmel decided that they like what he's doing there and have for a long time. I've been arguing all along that they like the amenities that they have. Jim Brainerd has a vision for what that community is going to be. And he's one of the few politicians I ever met in my life that actually delivered on that vision over and over and over again. And apparently the people up there like it because he won with 63% of the vote. And so, you know, I don't think they're very concerned about how they're going about it as long as they like what they're getting.
Not only did he win, he had a slate of candidates for the city council and all but one of them won. The president of the council's out. And then his nemesis has been the clerk treasurer, Diana Cordray, and his candidate beat her.
Well, it looks like he's pretty strong. You can't argue with that. There's no doubt about it. But in terms of challenging incumbents, you know, there are some other races that are interesting. Columbus, for example, where Christy Brown was a mentee of the governor, Mike Pence, and a Tea Party person herself, she was handily defeated
almost 2-1.
A Republican primary. And also in Bloomington, where John Hamilton had challenged Mark Cruzan the last time and lost, he won handily against Mark Cruzan's pick candidate this time. And he's going to be a very progressive leader, I think, for the Democratic Party and articulate some vision for the state.
Yeah, and in most of these cases, the primary was the election. Hamilton's got a Republican opponent, but he only got 300 votes.
Yeah, I think that the primary was the election there as well.
Yeah. Other Hamilton County races were noteworthy. Andy Cook in Westfield and John Ditzler in Noblesville were both challenged for much the same reasons as Brainerd was, and they won handily.
Yeah, Hamilton County is an interesting place because it's so heavily Republican. But it also is one of our wealthiest, if not the wealthiest, county, Johnson County, and some of the other ring counties are very wealthy. And by that, I mean they have a lot of capacity in their tax base, so they can do things that other communities can't. And so you have mayors in all of those three of those places who have been very aggressive in their programs. They've built these things. They've drawn critics, and now they've defeated those critics. So, you know, if you want to say you've got a mandate for your vision, I think all three of them can say that.
What people object to the growth in some respects, the critics do, but it looks like, by and large, the folks who live in these Hamilton County communities like where they're headed.
Well, certainly that's the conclusion that you could draw from the three municipalities you mentioned. If people were dissatisfied, this would have been an opportunity for them to show their frustration at the polling place and turn these people out of office. Clearly, these are known commodities. You look at Jim Brainerd, he's been around for, five terms? This will be a sixth term, so it's right. Not as if...
Don Ditzler's going for a fourth and Andy Cook for a third.
Yeah, so it's not as if you're thinking, jury's still out. I'm not sure if I'm liking this person or not. I think that the lines were clearly drawn, and people, I don't know if that's an aberration in terms of what you see with government-promoted spending of that sort and of that scope, but clearly it works in Hamilton County.
Well, in all three cases, all three mayors, Ditzler and Noblesville, Cook and Westfield, all have specific visions for what they're trying to do. It's not like they're just getting sprawl there.
Right.
They had very specific ideas, and in Cook's case, this whole idea of sports tourism is right. working, and people are seeing the benefits of that for the number of people that are coming in because of sports tourism.
Well, he proposed Grand Park before the last election, won by 61 votes in that election, before people knew what it was going to be.
And it's working.
And now that they've seen it, 60-40
win. They're bringing people into that community like they've never had before, just by the thousands, and it's working for them.
I think it shows quality of life is an issue. You hear mayors and municipal officials talk about it, that's the overriding factor that for a lot of people, and I think this bears that out.
All right. The November matchup for mayor of Indianapolis is set. Democrat Joe Hogsett and Republican Chuck Brewer both had big primary wins.
How do you go about conveying your vision for the future to persuadable voters? You go out, you engage neighborhood associations, civic groups, and present your ideas to them. Those are groups that are not partisan in nature. They care about their communities. They care about their neighborhoods. And you hope that your ideas will resonate with them.
I'm a strong leader. I got to tell you, I'm not very political. I'm a practical leader. I like listening to all sides of an issue before I make a decision. And that's how I plan to lead the city.
Ann Delaney, what are Chuck Brewer's chances?
Well, I wouldn't rate them very high, but I don't expect that he'll just fold. I assume he'll run a spirited campaign, and I assume both campaigns will put out their positions on different issues and articulate a clear-cut choice. And I expect that Hogsett will win. You've got to look at the demographics of this city, and they certainly have trended Democratic in recent years.
Well, and Joe Hogsett has higher name IDs, raised $2 million.
Brewer's
raised only $600,000. I mean, will Republicans concentrate more on the council?
Well, I think they're going to concentrate on the mayor's race. I really do. I think that they're going to make a fight of it. And it's correct in the standpoint that it's the demographics are turning Democrat. There's no question about that. But, nobody ever heard of Greg Ballard when he ran.
But they had heard of the record of his opponent.
Well, they had heard of the record of his opponent. And quite frankly, Joe Hogsett's run for a lot of offices before and hasn't always been successful. So, it could happen
again.
That's
true of Mike Pence, too.
Well,
and he wound up as governor.
He won governor. He's won Congress. Joe didn't have that kind of track record.
He won Secretary of State.
Yeah. What else?
From the former mayor.
This was, I think, a very unusual primary in that neither side campaigned prior to Election Day, certainly not in mass media. They're both waiting for the fall.
That's what the problem is. There hasn't been enough revenue generated for the TV stations.
I wouldn't say they have been silent. Look at your inbox, and the news releases have been, and the mailings, digital mailings to supporters and perceived supporters have been coming.
They didn't do direct mail to voters.
Maybe not to voters. There's an attempt to get earned media, but your point's well taken. It is a little bit different that you haven't seen an air war of the kind we're accustomed to. I presume that'll change heading into the general, but to echo what's been said, if you look at the numbers of this area and how it's changed even since Greg Ballard, to your point, Mike, even since he beat Bart Peterson, it's clearly Democratic, and I think the Republican nominee recognizes that, and that's why you hear statements such as, I'm a pragmatic candidate, I'm a pragmatic leader. As soon as you start hearing, I'm not a politician, I'm a pragmatic leader, that means I'm of the wrong party affiliation for this particular area.
Well, the most interesting thing I heard a candidate say this week was Joe Hogsett in his acceptance speech when he announced Indy welcomes all and said, I will be a mayor of ideas, not a mayor of ideology. He sounded like he was running against Mike Pence. Obviously, he thinks RFRA is an issue that he can capitalize on in a mayor's race.
Because for two reasons. One, the percentages of people who support LGBT issues is much higher in Marion County than it is for the rest of the state. And two, Chuck Brewer was absent on that issue when RFRA was going through. So his position is not known at this point. And so Joe's out in front of it. And if you're a candidate and you think you've got a winning issue, you get out in front of it.
It's very rare to have an open seat for mayor of Indianapolis. I mean, it's rare that incumbent mayors get beat. And usually it's after they've been there a while, even when they do get beat. And so this particular campaign, as Ann said, I think it's true. It's going to be about ideas because people are going to be eager to hear how the next person is going to be in charge of this city, where we've made tremendous progress over the course of a long time with mayors from both parties, quite frankly, good progress, are going to move the city forward. And I think that's why there's an opening here, because both of these candidates have to do that, have to give their vision for what the city's going to be, because people don't want to lose the progress that's been made here.
And RFRA, as it was initially passed and signed, if I'm not mistaken, would have precluded local protections in Indianapolis and other communities. So I guess it's a bit of, that's not the case now with the fix. But still, there is it's not maybe as much of a stretch to try to make it a home rule or a local issue as one might see on the surface.
I think he's absolutely right to make it an issue, because the point of the damage done to Indiana, and particularly to Indianapolis, is substantial by the governor's position. And it seems to me we have to rebut that image at every given opportunity so that people understand that not everybody feels the way the governor does.
The real issue for me in this election will be the city's financial capabilities and capacity, because they have been tapped. And unlike Hamilton County and the surrounding counties, which have that depth of tax base, Marion County does not. That's going to be the big challenge for whomever wins, and whomever can enunciate a good plan will have good way to go.
It's particularly acute here because of the percentage of not-for-profits and state agencies occupying prime land that generate zero tax revenue, and the state doesn't compensate for that.
All right. Turnout is not generally high for a municipal primary, and it certainly wasn't this time. Marion County election officials said they were hoping for a voter turnout of about 13%. They got 7%. In Hamilton County, where those three contested races for mayor, the turnout was 16%. Dominique Richmond didn't vote.
I didn't see that many advertisements about voting. If there would have been more, I probably would have been able to take a day off or take some time out to vote.
Sometimes the young folk don't understand how important it is to get their vote in. They think that my one vote, they think it don't count, but it counts.
That's Beverly Love, who did vote. John Ketzenberger, is this an argument to move the municipal elections to the presidential year?
No, I don't think so. I understand that argument that you have a greater turnout tendency and all of that. I think it's a better argument for changing the way we conduct our elections and going to a vote center model where you can identify areas where there's high traffic and easy access. You can extend the time that the vote centers are open. The capacity is all there. And I think over time, you could change the habits and hopefully raise the participation.
How about open primaries? It's an argument for
that's
some...
That's not a bad idea either.
It's an argument for some kind of change, isn't it?
You can make an argument that it's an argument for change. If it were held in a presidential...
7%?
You know what, though? That is pathetic.
You can make an argument.
That's pathetic. But frankly, the turnout is pathetic in presidential cycles as well, when you get right down to it. I mean, and if you look at the overall eligible pool of voters and who actually goes to the polls, not what it should be here or anywhere else. I mean, that's just an ongoing problem. And if you did move it, Jim, I guess for sake of discussion, to a presidential year, then you could make the argument that the municipal races would not get the attention they deserve because all of the proverbial oxygen would be sucked out of the room by the presidential contest.
You would have more options in the voting booth than the two that you had this year. The Kern and Shepard report suggested moving it to the presidential year.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I think it saves money. Clearly, an election in Marion County costs over $1 million now to put on, and that's a consideration. But I'm not a believer that you can legislate turnout. If people aren't interested, they're not going to show up. And it, clearly, in this particular case, nobody was interested because you didn't have a primary fight of any consequence on either side. Nobody did any media coverage of these candidates prior to the primary. I bet you didn't have 10 stories on your station about this.
We did stories.
I bet you didn't have 10 stories on it. Neither of them were on TV and in advertising. So, and there's this belief nowadays, if you're not on TV, you're not a campaign. And so none of that happened. And so people weren't paying attention, didn't really care, because they know the fight's going to be in the fall.
And I don't think you can understate the impact of legislation on this, okay? We discourage people from voting in the state, which is why we rank so poorly. It's true, it's down in lots of places.
This was the first Marion County election without the four at-large seats, which
you
limited your choices.
And you don't have school board, extend the hours. Right. Democrats offered to extend the hours, got one Republican vote in the House. We have the stupid voter ID stuff. We don't use internet access.
You have to be who you are.
Why not, for example, these are party choices the primary. Why can't the primary ask the party to mail out ballots,
to their own independent voters?
Independent voters can vote the same way, but if you want to increase the turnout, why can't the parties take care of that?
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the primary election be moved to the presidential year, the municipal elections? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, move it to the off year for congressional elections. Last week's question, what should Glenda Ritz run for? 35% said governor, 45% said reelection, 20% said nothing. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. There were mixed results in a number of school referendums this week. In Brownsburg, two referendums failed. One called for a new elementary building. The other called for high school improvements. Superintendent Jim Sharp says the student body is outgrowing the school buildings.
Tipping point here with our growth and the age of our failing facilities that we need to do something, and so the community has said just not now, and so we've got to come back and revisit that at some point here in the near future.
That's Jim Snap, John Schwanis. Is this evidence that the referendum law is working?
I guess you could make an argument that it is empowering voters to say whether or not they want to have hand deeper into their pocket in terms of taxation. And I think you're right, Jim. You said it's mixed results, and that's exactly what this was, because if you look not very far away at either Wayne Township or Perry Township in Marion County, or you look in Frankfort, there were successful referenda. And so it cut both ways, and that's why I'd hesitate to make any huge generalization about an anti-referendum or referendum mood or a pro. I think it's very local, as it is with the mayoral contest.
Is there an anti-tax mood?
Well, no. I think that what you see here is a mechanism that the legislature intended, and I will say I think it's working as the legislature wanted it to work. It's giving voters a direct hand in whether they want to pay more money for whatever it is that the school is selling, and that's up to the school. That's the big change here. I looked at the Brownsburg situation, and they have the ability to do this much greater than, say, Frankfort or the townships that you mentioned, yet they were not successful because there was a very good campaign against this. And by good, I mean they worked it, and they convinced the population not to vote for it. And so I think that's where we're at. We've got, a mechanism that we are getting used to, and we're in that cycle now, and we've had enough of them that it's working the way the legislature intended it to work.
Well, there's another factor in there, too, and that is if you look at where the budget, with this supposed big increase in education funding, which doesn't quite restore inflation loss over the last 2 years, the beneficiaries of that, are the suburban districts like this. And so Hendricks County made out on this. Wayne and Perry and the others in Marion County did not, and they didn't have a choice. So they had to do that and increase the debt load in order to provide the essential services. Brownsburg is not in the same situation, thanks to Mike Pence's budget. It's the rural and urban schools that got screwed under his budget.
Working?
70% of the referendum, of the 17 referendums that were on the ballot this time passed. The lesson over time is that if you want to have a referendum, do it in the primary, not in the general. About two-thirds of them pass when they're in the primary election. And less than half of them, more like 40%, pass when they're in a general election.
When there are more voters taking
when
part.
When there are more voters taking part. So if you're going to do one, do it in a primary election, because they're counting on people not showing
and
up.
And the importance of selling it, as John suggested. Frankfurt, the superintendent, said this was the result of 2 years of effort. So, I mean, this
about
is 70% very much
of
grassroots.
17 passed, so, yeah. I mean, you know, somebody wanted it.
Governor Pence acted on legislation passed by the General Assembly this week. He signed legislation including a bill called the SHIELD Bill that gives legal protections to health professionals, preventing them from being sued in cases where they volunteer their services. He also signed the state budget into law. And Friday afternoon, we learned that he has allowed the gaming bill, the one that permits riverboats to move on land, to become law without his signature. Mike McDaniel, what do you make of that?
I wasn't surprised that he allowed the big gaming law to come into, or the big gaming bill to come into effect, because that affects a lot of communities. It means a lot of jobs, especially construction jobs going forward. So I wasn't surprised at that one. He signed a lot of legislation this week, a lot of good legislation, including a balanced budget and a whole lot of other things that the legislature did that were good. And it was just too bad that they were distracted by the sideshows that we were distracted by during the session, because all the good things are going by the wayside.
He also vetoed a gambling bill.
He vetoed a gaming bill that allowed for advanced deposit wagering, which, again, wasn't a big surprise.
For horse racing.
For horse racing. But the other bigger gaming bill, I think, is more important to the future of the state.
Clearly, he's uncomfortable with gambling issues.
The nonsense of letting it become law without his signature is weak. But, of course, his whole governorship is weak. And anybody who talks about...
Or did he sign it?
Letting it become law without his signature.
So, and the idea that this session was anything other than disaster is, they're in a parallel universe. It destroyed the reputation. We're undermining wages. I mean, when you look at the construction wage issue, I mean, what you're doing is you're undermining, not only undermining the workers, you've picked one group of construction companies over another. Instead of the big companies that have provided jobs at living wages in Indiana, you pick the fly-by-nights. Not, in my book, a good bet. But,
you
so
hate
it's
it
a
when
disaster.
They save taxpayers' money. I know
it's
you do.
It's not saving taxpayers' money when you don't have people earning enough
20%.
Income to pay income tax, so income keeps going down.
John, you think there's any chance that his veto will be overridden?
On the gaming bill?
On the advanced deposit horse racing
No,
bill.
I'm afraid not. Sorry, Mike.
All right. Finally, the Deflategate investigation is over, and it puts New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady in a bad light. The NFL report from lawyer Tom Wells reveals that 11 of the 12 footballs used by the Patriots in a playoff game against the Colts were underinflated. Wells says it's likely two Patriots employees deliberately deflated them, and that star quarterback Tom Brady was aware of their actions. Andalini, should Tom Brady be suspended?
I think action should be taken. What kind of message does this send to kids out there? You had that little league team in Chicago that recruited outside their area, and they had their national championship stripped from them, a bunch of amateurs. You have professionals in here deliberately trying to cheat, or at least to gain an advantage that they're not entitled to. You have to take action.
Is Tom Brady the Gaylord Perry of football?
Yes, but I think this is that what should happen is I think it should take a page out of the NCAA playbook and say no postseason play next year for the New England Patriots.
That's a good answer.
That's a good idea.
I think it's a great idea.
Did the Colts do the right thing by tipping off the NFL?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the downside to that would be, other than are you suggesting that that's somehow paints them as a tattletale or something. But
Brady's agent says they took part in a sting operation.
They've been cheating
well,
for
that's,
over
I,
a year.
That's, come on. I think that's ludicrous. Come on. I think if I were the Colts front office, I think that's probably you're looking for.
So, you know, you didn't rat me out when I was trying to cheat before I did it. So therefore, you're
they
at fault.
They play here this year.
See, yeah. the I think you know Brady's agent's grasping at any straw he can. The Colts were mad because they allowed the game to happen. They wanted them to shut it down and not
beforehand.
Let them. Yeah, they didn't want this to go to a big investigation. They just wanted properly inflated footballs. That's all. Yeah.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T, rethink possible.